All right, hockey fans, listen up, because we've got something special cooked up for playoff season. It's called the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge, and it's going to add some serious spice to your playoff experience. Now, here's the deal. Every playoff game, you're going to be faced with a handful of questions. It's like your own personal playoff puzzle, and it's free to join. And there are prizes, because who doesn't love winning stuff? Daily winners, you're getting hooked up with gift cards. Treat yourself to some nation gear or maybe even your favorite jersey. And for the big dogs, the people who can win an entire round, it's straight, cold, hard cash. We're talking about real dough for your hockey knowledge. So lace up those skates, stretch those thumbs, and get ready to show off your hockey IQ in the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. Sign up today and play every game day at games.dailyfaceoff.com and prove your puck prowess.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the DFO Rundown Podcast with Frank Saravalli and Jason Greger on DailyFaceoff.com.
Welcome to episode 31 of the DFO Rundown. I'm Jason Greger, along with Frank Saravalli. He's in Philly. I'm in Edmonton, Canada. And we are in the woodjerseys.com studio. You'll see my nice Boston Bruins wood jersey behind me. You can get one. It fits in anywhere. The other thing I like, I might have to zoom in on it one of these days, Frank, because the intricacies that they put into this, it's fantastic. You can get yours at woodjerseys.com. It's an officially licensed NHL product, and they got new teams coming all the time. So Seattle fans coming in next season, they'll have one for you later on this summer. Woodjerseys.com. Frank, how you doing? How's your weekend?
I'm good. Did anything happen on Sunday?
Oh, wow. It was, it's quite the day. Like, you think about these NHL playoffs. So the 2018 Stanley Cup winner just lost four in a row. The Washington Capitals, they're out. The 2019 Stanley Cup winner, they got swept. The 2019 Stanley Cup finalist, they're not even in the playoffs. Right? Like, it, man, playoffs are tough. Playoffs are ruthless. So just ask the Edmonton Oilers. You know, you're down 3-0. You're up 3-1. Like, that's the third time since 2006, the Edmonton Oilers, 2006 game one Stanley Cup final, they lead 3-0, they lose the game. 2017 Anaheim Ducks, they're leading by 3 in the final 5 minutes, give up that lead, lose in overtime. And then same thing against the Winnipeg Jets last night. Like, it can be ruthless at times, man. It is a gut punch to fans and the players. And we'll see if Edmonton has anything left to bounce back and try to become the LA Kings or the Philadelphia Flyers. That's the other thing, Frank. It's happened twice in the last decade. You know, it only happened twice in the previous 100 years.
Yeah, you know, and I was actually covering that series in 2010 between the Flyers and Bruins. And the only thing that felt similar, and I'm not saying this to provide any glimmer of hope or to make a prediction, like, don't at me when I say this, is that the games were so insanely close in those first three games. They could have gone either way, that you never really felt like that team was out of it. And that team was the Flyers. And in this case, it's the Oilers. I mean, you have, think back to game one. It was essentially a one goal game with two empty netters. Game two goes to overtime scoreless, and, you know, it's an OT loss. And then you have this game, game three, where they're up by 3 goals with under 9 minutes to play. I mean, the way they had dominated that first period, it was easily the most lopsided period of the series for either team. And so then now they're down 3-0 in this hole. And man, it's going to be hard to climb out of. And I spent way more time, Jason, than any man rationally should, thinking about the Edmonton Oilers and their fan base's psyche over the last week, just with the text messages that were pouring in, the tweets that were pouring in after games 1 and 2, when McDavid and Draisaitl were held off the score sheet. And I was like, the trauma there, the pure trauma that exists. I actually get it at this point. Watching game 3, it was like a plane crash. It wasn't just one thing. Everyone wants to point to the Archibald penalty, and that of course was the turning point, but there were like 9 other things that took place in that game that had the end result being the crash. And man, that is, it's tough to stomach.
Oh, it was, my wife is not a huge hockey fan, but you know, so she'll watch in the playoffs. She likes that. She gets too emotionally involved in it. So I'm watching the game because obviously it's my job. And so she's watching it with me, and she normally doesn't watch. And, you know, she's excited with my son. He's 7. So, you know, he likes watching the games, and you know, it's 4-1, they're good. And then it's 4-2, 4-3, 4. When it goes 4-4, my wife's like, I don't know how people watch these games all year long. Like, I'm literally mad. I can't watch anymore. And she went upstairs and she wouldn't watch overtime. And I'm just like, you know what? A fan base, like a diehard fan, to feel that. And we've seen those. I don't know. Everybody always says a 3-goal lead's the worst lead in hockey. Well, you can ask Maple Leaf fans against the Boston Bruins. You know, I went through the list of other teams. Like, it's, there's something to it, man. And in playoffs, like, it rips your heart out. For fans, absolutely rips them out. And it's the one thing that I dislike being in media, is that I don't have that passion. But at the same time, when you, like, you know,
your
when
jaw still life, hits the floor though, like, you're just, yeah, like how did that possibly happen?
And you see your friends and you see how devastated they are by a loss. Oh. Right, you're just like, oof, it's tough. So we'll see what happens. And then on the other side though, you got the Nashville Predators coming back. And, you know, I'll say this, like, that was a 5-4 game. It could have been a 9-8 game. The saves, like, Nick Cousins got absolutely robbed twice by Nedeljkovic, once in the final minute of the game. UC Saros obviously set a franchise record for the Predators with most saves in a playoff game, 50 saves back-to-back games. And suddenly the Preds, Frank, are in that series.
Did not see that coming. I mean, not the way game 1 played out. And I know game 2 was closer with some empty netters, but man, like, I thought Carolina was in the driver's seat. And I think it really shows you how big of a swing that atmosphere can have. And I'm not saying that the Preds went home and won 2 games because they had a significant number of fans in the stands. Look, everywhere is increasing, but I do think there's something to be said for the environment. And also for Saros, I mean, look at the way he played in game 2, follows that up in games 3 and 4. Like, we talked about this before the playoffs started. If there was one team that could really make some noise in the first round as a 4 seed, it might have been the Preds because of Saros. The last 24 games, .948 save percentage. I mean, it's such a difference maker. You know, you look at a team like the Washington Capitals, for instance. They were banged up. They lose 4 straight. To fall out in the first round for, I think, the 3rd year in a row. And you look at, once Craig Anderson was out of the net, they had an .893 save percentage. Like, that's just not going to get it done.
No, it's, well, and you know, Nashville actually in the second half of the season had the most points of all those top 4 playoff teams in the Central. So that's why I said, of all the number 4 seeds, they were the ones I was given the best chance to. And obviously St. Louis is out. You know, Montreal's only played 2 games, so that series is tied. They're still in. And then you look at the Islanders, Pittsburgh, and that's a little bit different because they're only separated by 6 points. And you know, that one goes back and forth, Frank. What you've seen through 4 games, does it change your view at all? Do you think either team has an advantage, Islanders, Pens?
I don't think so. I mean, we talked about this on Friday, just the idea of the number of goals scored in that series. That's what's been so surprising. They've worked up a healthy level of hate. I just see those teams as really a dead heat. And I think the one team that has, and it's not just the way that they manhandled the Caps, but I mean, the Bruins are playing so well that I think they've shown themselves to be the clear favorite in the division. So I think whoever they're going up against in round 2, they're going to be in a nice spot.
And Montreal, Toronto will have game 3 tonight and then game 4 tomorrow. You look at the NHL, do you expect them to wait until all the series are done before they start the second round? Or are we going to have a little NBA potential crossover where if there's a game seven to be played, the game one of another division will go at the same time?
I hope they don't. They have, you know, they flirted with the idea before of starting early, but just in the case of, you know, for these teams' sake, like, I mean, Colorado, like if Vegas and Colorado can get done, you've got Colorado sitting there after the sweep. Vegas is now in a really nice spot in their series. You know, get these teams playing again. Don't have a team sit around for 8 or 9 days after their sweep. Sometimes you can't help it because you're waiting for your opponent. Their series goes seven and that happens, but don't have these teams. It puts them at a disadvantage. It's like, you know, you go and you sweep your series and then you start, you know, start over again 9 days after playing again. And you're like, how are we supposed to come out and win? Like it puts them in a really tough spot moving forward. So I'm hoping that they do start early.
And well, Nazem Kadri got 8 games over the weekend. He'll obviously at this point, he's going to miss the first 6 games of the next round. If it goes 6 games between Colorado and likely Vegas at this point, he does have the appeal process. He says he's going to appeal. Is there any more system that looks like a farce than the NHL appeal system? So number one, Gary Bettman's never, ever going to go against an NHL employee. So why they're even going to Gary Bettman first, to me, just seems like a stall tactic to delay it. So that takes a few extra days whenever they decide to look at it. Then you find an independent arbitrator. And we saw it with Tom Wilson. Tom Wilson got suspended 20 games. By the time the arbitrator ruled, he had already sat out 16 of those games. So they ruled and reduced it to 14, which means he still sat out 16, but it saved him the money. He only, because in the regular season, there was the fine. And so he only got fined for 14 games instead of 16. Nazem Kadri, do you think there's any chance that he gets his appeal heard before this 8 games are up?
It'll be heard. I just don't know if a ruling will be in place. And by the way,
well, same thing.
Yeah. I mean, you asked, can I think of, yeah, I mean, I can think of a few political kangaroo courts, but yeah, I mean, to this scale. And the other funny part about the arbitrator process is that these arbitrators have been fired somewhat often. I'd have to go back and do some digging in terms of, the original guys that are still in place. But the funny thing is when there's a ruling that either side doesn't like, then in the off season, they have a clause in the CBA where they can then terminate that arbitrator and bring in a new one for the next time. So, that happens seemingly routinely. And the other part of it is like, it's just not quick enough. Like this should be, you know, if you're going to make an appeal, especially at a critical time of year, I think you're right. Why have the commissioner hear it, even though he has the ultimate say in discipline for the league? Why have the commissioner hear it when you could just go right to the neutral and impartial arbitrator, have them, and then put in the CBA? Ruling must be made within 24 hours of the hearing. They could have the hearing, get all their ducks in a row legally, the proceedings, have it on, say, Wednesday, and then say, a judgment is due in 24 hours. Get it done. I mean, it shouldn't be that difficult, but I will say that in this case, precedent seems to be on the side of player safety here in terms of Kadri having any luck getting this reduced. It just seems like, you know, I've mentioned this before, the next step in the process, when you get suspended for 5 games for something and you do something similar, the penalty is incremental and it has nothing to do with repeat offender. That only has to do with the money involved. So it's an important reminder for everyone as they try and, you know, look at this process from 30,000 feet.
Yeah. And if you look at Nazem Kadri to defend himself, I'm not sure I see a strong enough defense to have any significant, like, I don't know, maybe an arbitrator would give him 7 games, but I don't see it cutting down because it's his third time in the playoffs and it's just, it builds up from it. Like he's got a past history. So you know, I understand why he's appealing. Like there's no harm in appealing it. I think the whole appeal process of the NHL is
could be overhauled.
Flawed. Yeah. And it doesn't really, it's not going to help him very much at all. Now we'll have Alan Walsh on, player agent. He's going to join us today. So very much looking forward to, here's a guy who knows a thing or two about appeals in the actual court of law, because he worked there for many years in LA before he became an NHL player agent. Although that was what he originally wanted to do. And we'll find out kind of how he got sidetracked and then how he kind of got back in it. And it has been at the forefront of it for a long time. So I look forward to that. A few other things, Frank, that I want to get to is, So here we are. You look at teams and the emotion from the postseason. You talk about Washington and, you know, their goaltending. Now, we thought having two young goalies at the start of the playoffs would be a concern. And obviously one got injured and, you know, Samsonov was out with Kuznetsov. What do you think the Capitals do in the offseason? Are they going to make a significant change? And Ovechkin didn't want to talk about a contract extension. Do you think there is any chance he doesn't re-sign in Washington?
No. No, I think the conversations between Alex Ovechkin, who's representing himself, by the way, and Brian McClellan and the Caps have been very positive, very cordial. I don't get any sense at all that either side is entertaining any sort of change. I just think that there's expansion draft considerations to make. And it'll be really curious to see whether Ovi walks into McClellan's office this week and says, let's get it done. And at that point, with the respect that McClellan has for Ovechkin and all that he's done for the franchise, putting it on the map, bringing a Stanley Cup to DC, you know, they're going to do it and get it signed. Expansion draft be damned. And so if they have to lose a guy by that route, then that's what they're going to do to make sure Alex Ovechkin is happy. I do think it's going to be a contract with a little bit of term, 3-4 years. Some people wonder if he matches up with Backstrom in terms of term. I think he has 4 years left. For me, I see that AAV somewhere around $11 million. I think there was some talk pre-pandemic that Ovechkin's ask was 12 and a half. Now, of course, it depends on term, but I think 11 sounds about right. And I think that's what the Caps are budgeting. But I do think, to answer your question, there's going to be significant changes there. I'd be really surprised if Kuznetsov is back, and not just for the stupid penalty that he took in the elimination game, but also just with the way that he's handled himself this year, the up and down nature of his play. You know, you look back to his production. He goes from, you know, when the Caps win the Stanley Cup, 1.05 points per game, 0.95, 0.81, 0.7. And you're like, this has just been a steady drop off for a guy that has 4 years left times 7.8 million. Now people say, can you still find a way to move that contract in this pandemic world? And I would say yes, given the talent that's there. And maybe he's one of those guys that getting a fresh start elsewhere wakes him up, and he's got the skill and skating ability to be able to really be an X factor, as we saw in the year that he almost won the Conn Smythe.
It's interesting, 11 mil for Ovechkin. Like, I think obviously Ovi's the best scorer of his generation. It's not even close. Arguably he's going to go down as the greatest goal scorer of all time. But
he is the greatest goal scorer of all time.
Yeah. Is he still that moving forward on the term of his contract? And that's,
he hasn't shown any real sign of slowing down.
Yeah, fair. Right.
I mean, look at the way that he got motor. Look, a little bit of a slow start this year. A lot of players did with starting in January. But I mean, he still ripped off some incredible months where you're like, this guy still has it.
Oh, no, he can score goals. There's no question about it. And, hey, on a weekend where Phil Mickelson becomes the first player at 50 to win a PGA championship, Tom Brady at 43 won the Super Bowl. So, hey, maybe age is just a number now more than ever with the advancements of training and everything else. It'll be fascinating to see.
By the way, I wanted to add this. So, like, if you give him some term, he's chasing Gretzky. He's chasing the goal record. Like, yeah. You got a franchise. Like I said, he's sold a lot of tickets there.
Oh,
he's
going
to continue to sell a lot of tickets there, and you're going to continue to reap that reward as he goes after that record.
No, I think agree.
There's a lot of value business wise in term.
If he's making 11 mil, does it give you a good chance to win?
He's at 9.7 now. Like, we're not really talking about that big of a difference. Yeah. I think you still have a chance. And look, he does the hardest thing in the game to do, and that's score.
Okay. Let's get to Alan Walsh. He is our big guest today, brought to you by Jock MKT, where you can stay in the game. Go to jockmkt.com, right? You got the promo code DFO50, which gets you $50 to play. Frank just played it on the weekend. Any success, Frank, at Jock MKT?
No, and thank God for that DFO50 promo code that got me 50 extra bones and a couple extra cracks at it, but it's difficult. You got to really mine some value in the players towards the bottom of the market. You guys that you think can break out, you got to buy low, sell
high. Luke Cunningham, baby. Yeah, Luke Cunningham.
perfect example, a guy that you probably could have got for $3 ends up right around $23-24, somewhere around there. And that's a nice payday depending on how many number of shares you got.
Yeah. So it's, you know what, you got to know the players and you got to know the stock market. You got to know when to sell, when to buy. So it's a combination of both, adds a little intrigue to it. So check it out. Use the promo code DFO50 to start out. You get $50 to try.
Our next guest grew up as a hockey obsessed Montrealer, but took an unusual path to becoming a prominent voice in the game as a player agent. He moved to Los Angeles, went to law school, and his first stop as an attorney was in the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, prosecuting murder cases as part of the hardcore gang division. Then he transitioned to the hockey world. Please welcome to the DFO Rundown, the co-managing director of Octagon Hockey, Alan Walsh. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you guys.
All right, so let's start here. I want to get Alan Walsh into storytelling mode. So you decide that you want to become a hockey agent. How exactly did you break in?
Well, I don't know if there's enough time to tell the whole story, but I'll give you the abridged version. I had so much overtime built up in the DA's office that in between murder cases, I would have 2 or 3 weeks where I was told to not come back to the office to eat up some of my overtime. So I would go back to Montreal and spend 2 weeks hanging out with my father. And I had been a DA for 5 years. I prosecuted about 40 murder cases, and I was looking to transition into something else. I didn't know exactly what, but I started thinking about becoming a hockey agent and representing players. And through a series of really happenstance meetings that first my dad had suggested, I talked to a journalist who put me in touch with a gentleman by the name of David Shadia, who in the 1970s was one of the top agents in all sports. And I end up walking into David's office. He agreed to see me for 20 minutes. Ostensibly to give me advice on how to build the hockey agency. And after the 20 minutes, we kept talking. 20 minutes became 3 hours, became 4 hours. And at the end of the 4 hours, he said, "You know, kid, one of my biggest regrets was getting out of the sports agent business. I never should have done it. I'd love to get back in. I've always thought about getting back in. Maybe you and I can do something together." And in his office on that day, we shook hands on a 50-50 partnership and together built an agency from scratch with no players at all to where after 5-6 years, we were representing approximately 25-30 players in the NHL.
So that's it? You just stop prosecuting murder cases and you leave the DA's office cold turkey?
The DA's office, didn't have a client, didn't have much money, didn't really know what I was doing. I just had a very strong belief in myself. I wasn't married. I had no kids. I had almost no expenses. And I was, you know, the first 2-3 years that David and I were together, I was getting in my car in Montreal and driving to Ottawa, to Belleville, to Oshawa, to Toronto, to Niagara Falls, to Erie, and back to Montreal, then getting on a plane, going to LA, then getting on a plane and going to Saskatoon and driving Saskatoon to Regina, to Fort Capel. And within a couple of months, I was getting on planes and flying to Moscow and then flying to Czech Republic and Slovakia and Sweden and Finland, and we were go. And things broke our way. We had a couple of lucky breaks along the way.
You speak of those lucky breaks, but you kind of got to work to get your breaks. I'd read an article about you a few years ago where you got some advice from a judge who said, "Hey kid, you only got so many court cases. You're going to burn yourself out." Were you at that point, you know, you were working all the time, you mentioned all the overtime. Did you just need to mentally and physically get out of it? Did you feel that burnout, or did you just transfer that exact same work ethic right into a player agent and just be like, "Well, this one maybe isn't as taxing on me. I'm not having nightmares about murder cases, just negotiation with GMs."
It's an amazing question and something that I pondered a lot myself at the time. I remember that conversation with that judge, like it was happening today right in front of me. He did call me aside and say, hey kid, you got to slow down. And this judge was a former prosecutor, and he was a very senior judge in the LA Superior Court at the time. And he said, at the clip you're going, you're gonna burn out at 30. And I wouldn't say that I was burnt out. I would say that I had reached my fill on doing what I was doing and needed to do something else. When you're trying murder cases, you are really surrounded all day by murder, by death, by human tragedy. And I really bonded with the victims of almost every case I ever handled. And you feel their pain. I felt a very sacred duty going into a courtroom and thinking that this person has been killed and it's my job to seek some measure of justice for what happened. And that's a tremendous burden and responsibility for a kid in his 20s. I mean, I was 25, 26 years old with almost no help at all, going in and getting these cases 5-6 days before jury selection and picking juries and finding witnesses in the middle of the night with my homicide detectives. And I've said this before, if you try a murder case the right way, you cut out a little piece of your soul and you leave it with that case. And I found that after 40 murder cases, 40 trials, you only have so many pieces of your soul to give away. You do get desensitized and dehumanized to human tragedy. I didn't like what I saw happening to me at the time. And I really felt that there wasn't anything more that I could accomplish where I was. And it was time, I was the right age and it was the right time in my life to take on a new challenge.
So when you make that transition, and you talked about how you really felt that you needed to speak up for the victims. You came in kind of the mid 90s in the NHL where, lots was changing for the players and, they were trying to get more of a voice. Now, obviously it's not life or death. It's a completely different level of standing up for someone though, who maybe had been taken advantage of at times earlier. Was that an intrigue? Did that connect with you at all at that time?
Yeah, what I did is in making the decision to represent players, I did a lot of soul searching about what kind of agent I wanted to be. I wanted to create or fashion a set of values that I live by that players who work with me know they can trust and expect a certain level of dedication and loyalty to them. And I was always trying to think a little bit out of the box. When I started in 1995, there weren't certainly not as many agents as there are today, but the agents that were long established had a stranglehold on the marketplace. And it was not easy getting started when you didn't have any current clients in the National Hockey League. That was not an easy thing to do. So there were, at least in the first couple of years, people who players and families who looked at me and said, well, he doesn't have a lot of experience, but he has an experienced partner who is involved and who is mentoring him. And that's what David did every step of the way. But they also, in some measure, believed in the fire that resided inside of me, that whatever came at us, we would be in it together, and their battles were my battles, And really that's the soul searching that I went through before I even started in the business. And then of course I learned a lot once I actually got started.
Mm-hmm. So 26 years later, that fire is obviously still there, but how do you walk the line in a hockey culture where you're programmed to not say anything? Whatever opinion you have, you keep it to yourself. You might tell your spouse, you might tell your close friend if you're a player, but you don't really say anything to anyone else otherwise. How do you walk that line between supporting your players and their beliefs and, you know, taking on their battles as your battles, but also, you know, maintaining relationships and keeping everyone in the right spot?
You know, you never look for a fight with anybody ever. Anytime you're doing that, you're wrong. You're in the wrong before you even start. And really it's all very situational. There are times to say something. There are times to be quiet. Even begin to fashion any kind of a strategy, you have to know that the bond that exists between you and your client is so strong that nobody or nothing can break that. And I've been in situations in the past that no one has ever heard about, no one will ever hear about, but I know and the client knows what happened behind the scenes to get a result that was favorable for the client. And I'm happy with those stories never seeing the light of day. But I've also, as you well know, have at times done things that have been somewhat public. When that has occurred, there's been a reason behind it. It's not some hockey agent for dummies 101 guy sitting behind a keyboard, typing away at something and saying, hey, let's see what happens. There's a strategy behind everything that I've done. And I think for the most part, situations have worked out favorably for the client after something has occurred.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to ask you about the meme that surfaced last year in the playoffs with Marc-Andre Fleury. I think enough has been said about that, but I want to know, how did Alan Walsh raise hell pre-social media?
Well, it was a lot more difficult. Back before social media, so we're going to, 2000s up until around 2008, 2009, the beat writers in each city and what appeared in the newspaper the next morning, there was a totally different cycle to the news cycle that existed back then, because those stories stood alone and were the stories of the day for at least 24 hours until the next day's edition hit with the new story. So there were ways to do things, but they're really I would say the advantage was always with the club in every situation, because there were longstanding relationships with beat writers in the key cities. And if something got put out there, it was very difficult for a player or an agent to respond, and certainly almost impossible to respond in real time and get their message out or counter messaging out in any respect. But certainly social media was the big game changer and equalizer for the players in those situations.
Alan, I think it's safe to say, you mentioned, it wasn't just a split second decision. You obviously would confer with your clients. Do you find, because you're unique in the fact you've always not been afraid to stand up. You're obviously, I'm assuming probably when you were working back in LA, you might've had some threats from actual gang people. So I'm sure you're not worried about media types or an NHL GM saying anything now, but do you find does certain personalities, like when you want to work with players, do you need players who aren't afraid to stand up, or, can you kind of balance that to two? Do you think that works for or against you sometimes just in your willingness to maybe color outside the lines where some people don't?
It really, I fashion my reaction and my strategy and my advice. It's tailored to the client and the client's personality. And in many times, the client and his family together, and part of that is if you're the kind of agent that doesn't really know your client and their families, it's very hard when a player gets into a little bit of a sticky situation to really rely. They don't know you. But when you are like part of the family, when you are a constant presence in their life, not as somebody to bang them on the shoulder and tell them what a great game they played, because I've never done that in my life and I will never do that, but someone who is intricately involved in setting up a player's financial life, very involved in their marketing strategy and negotiating and bringing endorsement deals to the table. Having an in-house concierge service that is there for players when they need something, whether it's, they're on the road and they need something, they're on the road and their wife or their girlfriend needs something. Having the resources in our office to be able to take care of that, you find that you become a trusted day-to-day advisor and mentor. You're representing 20-year-olds who become 25-year-olds who become 30-year-olds, and you see how much more knowledgeable they become. And part of my goal is to constantly educate players. So based on whatever their interests are, I have a young player, 22 years old in the NHL, who's taking an online business class. And we work together to pick the class, what the subject matter would be that would most interest him. And he would, a couple of times a week, send me questions about the stock market, the bond market, inflation, what's inflation? And we'd have a running dialogue on that. So whenever I'm going through the Wall Street Journal in the morning and I see an article, discussing inflation, I'll flip it to him and say, here, read this. And it's, for me, it's the player is sitting there and I think he's thinking, wow, my agent is thinking about me and things that I'm interested in. And sending this to me because he read it and thought, wow, this is something I would like to read. And whether it's players who have a particular interest in different training, I'll read something about the latest and greatest that comes across my desk from an Octagon basketball agent or an Octagon football agent, and send it to a player and say, hey, what do you think about this? Would you like to explore this? There's this going on all day with everyone that I'm representing. So you're a constant presence in their life. And when you get to that point where this trust has been bonded together over years, something is happening that is threatening the player's career, they will turn to you. And you're there at that time to give them the best advice possible, tailored to them and their goals.
And last one for me, when you have to deal with your players, and you mentioned you're not a big pat on the back guy, when it comes to negotiations for new contracts, and some guys are coming off a career year, I'm assuming those ones are maybe a little bit easier, where the guys maybe all of a sudden, you know what, they haven't produced at the level they've wanted to the last few years. How do those conversations go? Do you know when to be the kind of the hard ass guy who has to kind of maybe give him a reality check to say, hey man, like, don't blame everyone else. This is, we got to look in the mirror. Or sometimes it's like, you know what? Hey, maybe there is external influences here that are having a bigger impact than we think. How do you balance that to know what's the right time or the right team or the right situation for a guy when it's pending free agency?
I would say that the most important thing is to always be brutally honest with a player. And when you have no fear of being honest with a client, you know, there's a lot of power in that, because the player and their families know, okay, this guy's got our back. This guy has been with us for a very long time, but he's not going to sugarcoat things. There are lots of conversations I've had with players where I've said, contract is up. I don't know what's going to happen in the offseason, but we're in trouble right now, and you need to know that. What I find is that the worst thing for a player is to not be given the honest truth. As long as you are not afraid to be brutally honest with your player, good or bad, they will hear the message and they will get it. You know, I never need to give a player, everybody they work with wants success. They want to be successful. They want to win. Everyone, they care. You know, I can't remember a player I've ever worked with who didn't care about winning or didn't go the extra mile to try to better themselves. They care about their careers. So every player has a beginning, a middle, and an end to their careers. And once a player enters into the middle era of their career, they're doing everything they can to prolong the point where they get to the end. Everybody I've ever worked with, they care so much about winning, their team, their teammates. So I think your job is to be there with them along that road and to get them ready for the next step. And in many respects, I've worked with guys near the end of their careers to help them with that transition from the last year or two of their careers to life in retirement.
Awesome. Okay, Al, we'd like to wrap up with Rapid Fire, brought to you by Manscaped. Go to manscaped.com where you can get 20% off and free shipping when you use the promo code DFO21. They're promoting the Lawnmower 4.0. As Frank likes to say, gentlemen, it's not just a gift for you, it's also a gift for your wife. So keep everything nice and tidy and trim, manscaped.com. Okay, Al, the only rule in Rapid Fire, you got to answer all the questions. Okay, so we'll start with the easy one. What is your favorite meal to cook?
Steak.
Okay. Now, which of all the players you've represented do you think would make the best player agent, and why?
Max Pacioretty. He will be a great agent one day.
Okay. If you could be commissioner, what's one rule you would change or introduce to the NHL currently?
First of all, I will never be NHL commissioner. I can guarantee you of that. But I would institute immediately a strict liability rule against any hits to the head.
Ooh, okay. What was the best advice David Shadia gave you when you guys became partners?
David Shadia, from our first meeting, said to me, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Now, to the Fleury GIF, did you design it or did you have somebody design it for you?
No comment.
And if you look to the NHL, it's 32 teams now. Do you think more expansion's better for the league, or is 32 a good number for the foreseeable future?
I think 32 is a good number for the foreseeable future. I think the NHL has to focus on propping up the franchises that may not be doing so well right now, and that should be their focus before looking to expand anywhere beyond 32.
Awesome stuff, Al. We really appreciate Alan taking the time to join us today in the DFO Rundown.
Great to be with you guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Alan.
You got it.
Now, Alan Walsh, very interesting gentleman, Frank. Just what going from all those murder cases, like I really liked how he described it, the fact that it's like a piece of your soul gets gone every time. Like I being surrounded by death all the time, I couldn't imagine that. So it sounds like he made a right decision to deviate from that, but learned a lot. And you know what? He's very unique in the agent world, because I appreciate him, because he's not afraid to speak his mind. And he's like, as long as my client, and that's my number one focus, as long as my client's happy, I don't care what other people think.
Yeah. And it's a really refreshing approach, because, you know, there's lots of agents out there that do a really nice job with their clients. But I don't get the sense that the connection is quite the same as the one that Alan Walsh has with his clients. And that's not to knock on anyone else. It's just, you can tell that there's sort of that bond that exists there, that the way he was describing it, it almost sounds like a marriage. And there's lots of guys that enter the NHL, they sign with their agent, and they don't hear from them at all until it's time to do their next contract. And not to say that that's the wrong way to do business. That's the primary reason that you're with that agent, is to help you with that next deal. But there's so many other things that happen in between: life events, family events, injuries, you know, all those things that pop up. And I just, it's different. And so to have that on, to have Alan on to point all that out, you know, we didn't even get a chance to ask him about, you know, what it's like going from regular season Alan Walsh to playoff Alan Walsh. You've got all these players, you know, take front and center stage in the playoffs, from Marc-Andre Fleury, Max Pacioretty, as he mentioned, he's out hurt right now, but Jonathan Huberdeau in Florida and David Perron in St. Louis. And so, you know, you really dive in, and you can tell it's like you watch him tweet. He's like, he's got to be glued to the TV during the playoffs at all moments, cheering on his guys. So nice to have that refreshing outlook. And I always enjoy a unique path, you know, to the NHL and to the hockey world. It's different, and it's an amazing story.
And speaking of different paths, we got some young guys coming in. Cole Caulfield, you talked, I think you said, was it nighttime coming in Florida with Spencer Knight, as Florida's on the brink of elimination. But it's interesting that Caulfield's coming in for Thomas Tatar, who is a pending free agent, Frank. You're getting healthy scratch in the playoffs. Are we talking a Mike Hoffman deal for Thomas Tatar now, a one-year deal? What do you think?
I was always thinking Thomas Tatar was going to be on a one-year deal, and this doesn't change that. I actually, when I was doing the free agent frenzy rankings for the last time, I had to double check that Thomas Tatar was only 30, because you watch him play and you feel like he might be a little bit older than that, 33, 34. And so, yeah, I think he was always a guy that was trending towards that one-year deal. And I don't understand why Cole Caulfield was ever out of the lineup. For a team that struggles to score, there's one thing that he does really well, and that's put the puck in the net. You need him in the mix. Take out someone else if you need. And I kind of alluded to the idea of it in episode 30, Spencer Knight. Look, Chris Driedger didn't get it done. Sergei Bobrovsky hasn't gotten it done. You've got a first-round pick with the pedigree in Spencer Knight. I know it's a rare spot to throw such a young goalie new to the NHL into the mix, but I think you always see a rallying cry from your players that, you know, want to play a little bit better, a little bit tighter when there's someone new in the mix. And I think you could see that with Spencer Knight for a team that, that has also been pretty close against Tampa in this series.
Yeah, they've been very close. And the thing about playoffs is, for any rookie, they realize quickly it's a completely different ball game than it was in the end of the season, and you know, there's more physicality. You know, guys are crashing from a goaltender perspective, so it's something interesting to watch. You know, we got some teams that will be eliminated. We've already got one out in two out in Washington, and of course, Colorado sweeps St. Louis. Edmonton's on the brink. Florida's on the brink. You know, we got a few other, Minnesota's on the brink. So this will be an interesting week. You know, by the time we get to Friday, it'll definitely probably be a few more teams out of it, Frank. So have yourself a great week, and we will talk to you on Friday.
Thanks for listening to the DFO Rundown with Saravalli and Gregor. Keep it locked on dailyfaceoff.com and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from to never miss an episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
All right, hockey fans, listen up, because we've got something special coming your way this playoff season. It's called the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge, and let me tell you, it's going to add some serious spice to your playoff experience. Now here's the deal. Every playoff game day, you're going to be faced with four questions. It's like your own personal playoff puzzle. And here's a sneak peek into some of those questions we'll be firing your way. First up, you gotta pick the winning team. That sounds simple, right? But there's more. You gotta decide if the total amount of goals in the game will be over or under a certain amount, and that's where the real strategy starts to kick in. Next up, you're picking who's gonna find the back of the net first, and you're gonna wanna be careful, because that's one that could be cooked early on in the game. And finally, you gotta predict which period is going to be the highest scoring. Will it be a barn burner in the first, a shootout in the second, or a nail biter in the third? That's up to you to decide. Now let's talk about prizes, because who doesn't love winning stuff? For the daily winners, you're getting hooked up with gift cards to treat yourself to some fresh nation gear, and you might even win a jersey from your favorite team. And for the big dogs, those who can win an entire round, it's straight, cold, hard cash. We're talking real dough for your hockey knowledge. So lace up those skates, stretch those thumbs, and get ready to show off your hockey IQ in the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. Play now at games.dailyfaceoff.com and prove your puck prowess.